it wants to be healthy. This is a very important thing to know, because our bodies are the best chemical factory that you could ever make, that is uniquely tuned in and tailored to your particular body at a particular time, manipulating and creating chemicals and enzymes and antibodies in ways that no amount of intellect or control could do. And it's doing it all automatically. This is nature. This is the will to live. And this is aliveness. And one of the characteristics, and not just in human beings, I believe, but certainly with human beings, is that one of the characteristics of really being able to heal is feeling love. That when you feel love for someone who is ill, when you wish them well, you facilitate them healing themselves, their body aligning with that which is greater, aligning with the natural order that wants to be healthy. This is why the will to live, inspiration, goodwill, prayer are all very real powers to help people heal, and often are the determining powers, the most significant, the most potent. And it's why people survive disastrous experiences, both medically and accidentally. They do because their bodies mobilize, they wish to live. There's so many times I've heard doctors say, well, I don't know how this person could have lived, because it goes against their ideology of how it's supposed to work. And so they act as though it was a fluke or it just wasn't supposed to happen. And it's not. It's the opposite. It's exactly how it happens. And when you use both, it's like using both hemispheres of your brain, using the logical linear side to keep track accurately of facts and details, to have the mechanical means to provide the sanitation and the physical container almost, physical realm in which you are working with someone who's ill, to keep that as positive and healthy and healing as you can make it. This is part of the logic of things, the mechanical part. Very important. But equally, at least, or more important, is the emotional, energetic presence. I often call it a numinous presence. Numinous is one of my favorite words. And for me, numinous is that quality of God experienced. Or perhaps you could even just say it's a mysterious power that makes you realize you are in the presence of something holy or spiritual. Something inextricably connected to that greater whole, that more wonderful whole, that aligns and heals with a power that's just by joining. This reminds me of a parable of Lao Tzu, the father of Taoist thought. And he was a wonderful mystical philosopher that lived in China. Around, I think he preceded Buddha and Confucius. I may be mistaken on that, but I think he did. And his philosophy was one a lot like Jesus. And it's interesting that Jesus brought into a very mechanistic, literal, overly linear world the power of love and the mystical power of love. Lao Tzu brought into a kind of yin culture an even bigger leap into following the flow of the universe. So it's very similar. Jesus emphasized the love and the flow and the power of the love. But Lao Tzu understood this bigger energetic context that we live in, and he called it the Tao. And T-A-O. And the Tao is the flow. It's the flow of the universe. And I used to I'd like to say in my workshop, I'm going to define the word Tao, which is indefinable. As long as you know it's indefinable, I can begin to try to define it, which is it is the order, the natural flow of the universe, the whole. Maybe in modern terms, we would call it the moving hologram of the whole universe, and everything's connected. And this quality of the Tao is something to surrender to not waste a lot of energy beating ourselves up, judging ourselves, beating other people up psychologically and physically too, energetically, with judgmentalism. This is a very painful part of our immaturity, a very painful part of where we're stuck, and it causes this process of beating ourselves up, not trusting the flow of things. It causes much disease, and it's interesting that the diseases we have that are most killing of our population are cardiovascular and autoimmune. And if you think of what that actually is, the autoimmune is that you're disconnected from your own immune system. You're disconnected from trusting it, from allowing it by harboring parts of your body in a contained, disconnected way where there's injury, where there's emotional wounding. You almost like disown that part, trying to get away from the emotional pain. And by disowning it, what we do is we disown our immune system. And another form of disowning is all the addiction, the addictions that we have as a culture, of drugs, of sex, of alcohol and cigarettes, and which are all drugs too, but the other they've been classified separately in our minds to make them acceptable. But all of that stuff is a form of numbing out. That's what they do. They numb us, and they help us not feel pain. And we have often people who are addictive personalities are very sensitive people, and they've been injured, and they don't know how to process the injury. And so it keeps swirling inside, causing them pain. And to manage the pain, they medicate. Self-medicate is the kind of in term, I guess, with alcohol and drugs and even cigarettes. They numb you down. They constrict your blood vessels. They make you feel less. It's not a buzz of elevation. It's a buzz of numbness that reduces your capability to perceive and to sense and to feel, which is why you are often left at the level of your lowest emotional awareness, that which can't be still numbed whenever you get aggravated, then it comes up through the drugs and makes you want to take another drink or makes you do irrational behavior, because it's just the numbing. It's incapacitating you, but it's leaving sort of the lowest common denominator of your injury and awareness floating in there. So healing is about processing that. Healing is about releasing it and bringing it to a new level. This is the it that I'm speaking of is the energetic movement of your body, the spiritual consciousness of your body, the emotional consciousness is allowed to develop and transform and process. So when you process old injury, what happens, the definition for me of the process, is you feel it again. You relive it to relieve it. You relive the trauma. Mostly what we're doing is avoiding feeling the trauma again. That keeps it building, growing, hovering in the background, and never leaving, because it's not processed. And our bodies are built to hold trauma till we are mature enough to process it. We just don't have quite enough collective awareness to be compassionate, to be truly helpful in judgmental and do a kind of healthy intervention by perceiving reality and say, well, you know, you just need to go through the process of feeling your despair that your father lost his temper and beat you. Even though you love your father and there's many things, and this is the paradox, it's often a trap because we feel that if we allow ourselves, especially childhood pain, we allow ourselves to face it with either our thinking, we will have to not love our parents. And that's not true. We can love our parents and see that they were dysfunctional and that they harmed us and that it harmed our body. And we don't have to hate them for that. We just have to grow from it, learn from it, and self-correct from it so that we don't hand it down to our children directly or even indirectly. Sometimes we hand down the wound by avoiding it so much we almost abandon our children in certain areas from authentic response, authentic seeing, an ability to be present in a very full way and loving and correcting. That's sometimes very difficult. So what we're really doing is learning how to mature beyond just deadlocking pain or injury, and that when we get a dis-ease in the body, we allow the dis-ease to be felt. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And I remember reading somewhere, I think it was Bruce Lee, and I wish I had the quote right handy, I don't, but he was saying something about you have to make friends with your injury and your disease. Because when you make friends with it, when you feel it, you know, that's how you heal it. And he's exactly right. And if you ever, how can I say it? If you ever go through the process of healing something and are deeply self-reflective, perhaps of your dreams, because, you know, we trust our dreams because we don't really have control over them. And when we dream something that's really pointing out a dynamic that we think we're not concerned with, we kind of say, uh-oh, I guess I really am concerned about that. And we look at it again. Plus, dreams think in intuitive metaphorical images. So when a dream is very bizarre, you know, or very ugly, what we sometimes call nightmares, but when a dream is very extreme, that's the dream's way of raising its voice. It doesn't mean the ugliness is something that's going to happen or is necessarily. It's the dynamic the dream is talking about you're ignoring. And you've had many dreams before about it. And if you keep ignoring it, the way the dream gets your attention, the way it raises the volume, in other words, the way it yells at you, is to make the dream harsh, to make it shake you up so you tend to wake up and remember it. And, of course, our linear mind goes, ooh, I murdered somebody in this dream, I did this, I did that, or this horrible thing happened to me, or this is really gross and weird. And we come to all these judgmental, linear, immature-minded evaluations, and we push it out of our mind as fast as possible. And, of course, if we could let the metaphorical mind be a metaphor, an energetic truth, but speaking in imagery instead of literal truth, the way Jesus always described that he had to speak in parable, not literal truth, but parable. Because when you're teaching something, the linear mind does not understand yet, does not have a category for, does not have box for, does not have a trail to run down automatically. When it's new, when it's really creative, when it is in the process of healing, then it's pioneering new ground for the linear mind. But the linear mind becomes uncomfortable, just the way doctors become uncomfortable when you bring up other forms of healing, because they don't know about it. And if they don't know about it, then it can't be. It can't be because they don't know about it. And, of course, that is, well, I guess that's called narrow-minded. That's called having blinders on. And that causes injury, but it's the same thing we all do. We all do it. We all do it, especially whenever you are pioneering on the edge of something painful or something that has been difficult to look at. Listen, if it were easy to see, you would have seen it already. The things that, especially in our later years, the things that tend to come up to be really sticking points are the things that at some level we have judged not possible to look at, which is never true. Never true. And if I could just send out the loving support to realize that that is never true, that you can look at everything, and that what is on the other side of looking at it, understanding, digesting it, growing from it, evolving from it, what's on the other side is great wisdom, great capacity to empathize with other people, and in fact, the capacity to be a healing person, a healing energetic influence on other people, because not only there but the grace of God do go you, there but the grace of God did go you. And you came through the other side realizing the value, realizing what the dis-ease represented. So therefore, there is a calmness. There's a numinous quality. There is a quality of that presence. There's a quality of love, a quality of self-forgiveness for having been stuck for so long, and more than likely, if not absolutely, but certainly more than likely, when you were stuck, you were injuring other people. Because that's what happened. Because when someone would come to you inadvertently or overtly trying to understand or touch that place you're defended against, they get whacked. They get put down. And sometimes it's because they've come at you in an attacking way. Sometimes it's not. And that's also what causes us to, when we are injured, to seek out codependent people to be with. People who have some matching dynamic. They're as afraid of facing their peace. And it's almost as though many people marry become close sometimes because they have a matching agreement, a matching dynamic of offness. They may have love also. They may have very real matching love and much affection, but they can also have matching unhealthiness. And that's what enablers are, because they want it energetically. They don't really want you to completely suffer. That maybe sometimes they do, but usually that's not it. Usually they just don't want to suffer themselves. They enable you because it distracts you. You distract them from having to face themselves. You become the problem. And that's why enablers enable people who have injury to keep it and to not process it. And it's not so sinister in any way. Sometimes it is, but usually it's not. Usually it's just everybody's afraid to feel it. And they don't realize, they don't have the emotional support, the spiritual support, the love around them, the insight, somebody with enough groundedness who's already been there and understands to help them face it with a more calm, energetic as things unfold. And that's, of course, exactly what's needed. And I do believe that is the main, well, there's two or three really great things about AA. And one is the anonymity, so that it's not about I know more than you know kind of thing. It isn't about a one-upsmanship, which is often a dynamic that's running people that drink, because they came almost always from a judgmental family, where whether it was harsh or seductive, it was still judgmental. And of course, this is a safe thing for me to say because that's almost everything that there is, but extremely so. And for sensitive people, this builds up an emotional, psychological strive very hard, some people, very conscientiously, to do everything they can to be right, to be good. But they keep getting caught in the duality flip trap. Now, the duality flip is something I invented a long time ago, because every time I tried to talk about this very thing, I would feel people just flip to the opposite side. So if I was talking about the value and the power of yin thinking, then they would make the yang thinking bad. And you will find abundantly in the culture, if you are making the linear thinking correct, all the intuitive thinking is bad. It's superstitious, it's la-la land, it's not real. And of course there can be superstition and there can be la-la land, just as with linear mind, there can be authoritarianism and reactionaryism and blindness, which is very damaging. But it's also a wonderful thing to be logical and to keep track of things. And it's a wonderful thing to be intuitive and inspired. And so it's not either or. So what the duality flip is, I used to say this in workshops, if I say to the group, I am completely for X, I am completely for it, how many people just automatically assume I'm against its opposite? And almost everybody raises their hand. Because if you're completely for something, it's as though it is logic to be against its opposite. But that is not true. And it is not entirely logical either. It's only either-or thinking. Logic can be bigger than that. Logic can encompass the fact of paradox that you can be completely for something and also for its opposite, because there is value in both. You're just talking about the best parts of both sides. So that's why I made this T-shirt that I have that shows a picture of the Earth and the words go around it, going upside down, depending on whether you're the one looking at it when it's on you or you're standing in front of the person. But it says you can't take sides when you know the Earth is round. And that whole idea came to me. I was meditating one time and I really want a something to share with people that shows the linear mind and the visual mind simultaneously working. The literal mind, the words, and the vision of bigger than. And of course, perfect is a sphere, because on a sphere, everybody standing on a sphere is standing upright. Everybody else looks crooked. So when you know, and you see, I often like to tell people, think of those letters in You Can't Take Sides When You Know the Earth is Round, as an individual, as a person. And everybody needs everybody else's perspective to get the whole story. You need to have other people's perspective. It doesn't mean that they are necessarily right, with a capital R, you know, they're right. They're always partly right. Everybody's always partly right about something. And even can be quite completely right about something and be different than somebody else who sees it differently, because they're standing in a different perspective, in a different position, with a different reality, a different environment, a different point of view, and a different function. So this is the consciousness beyond duality. And this is very important in allowing the process of healing, because the real trap in physical healing and in emotional healing is that we just won't let go of being right, or letting go, if we're not right, we're wrong. And if we're wrong, oh my goodness, then it's as though we don't deserve to live. And this is all not true. The whole point is that we are learning how to evolve, to hold the bigger picture, to be comfortable in it. And every time we reach despair, every time we feel trapped and want to numb out, we are at the very portal of the leap to a consciousness that is so much greater and so much more wonderful. And what we need in those moments is to understand this bigger picture and to have some humility. You know, humility is very important, I think, to define, because humility doesn't mean grovel. You know, it doesn't mean be, you know, this doormat, or just as when Jesus said, it's the meek that shall inherit the earth. That's what he meant, the humble, but he didn't mean grovel, meek, doormat. He meant the receptive, the willingness to take a moment to be modest or respectful, to be not so full that you can't let something new in. That's the power of modesty. And to be respectful lets you look again. But it means literally re-see. And I just realized as I was saying all this, I never finished the parable of Lao Tzu about the flow. And I do want to, so I'm going to just interject it right here, and so I don't forget it again. And what it was he was asked about what was a man of the Tao like. And he said, well, a man who's not of the Tao will fall into a raging river, and he will struggle to swim to shore, and he will drown. But a man of the Tao, when he falls into the raging river, will float and relax. And then he will let himself be carried to the shore. And I always like to add, and he will end up in a place on the shore where he really wanted to go but didn't even know how to ask the question to get there. And the Tao will lift you and put you there through the adversity of falling into the raging river. This is a different philosophy than control and power over and dominating and being right. This is part of trusting that flow. And what humility is really about is the ability to re-see things in people, to self-correct, to re-see things in yourself, to self-correct it, to not be so attached or humiliated by being wrong. You will be pleased to have discovered it rather than waste energy feeling bad that you were wrong. And which gets back to another one of those AA things, is that you rectify the wrongs in the way that you best can that doesn't cause harm to the other person or to yourself. Rectification isn't, and humility aren't about debasing yourself. It's not about harming you. That's old style thinking. It's quite the contrary. You are actually amplifying yourself by being more expanded of heart, more expanded in perception and capability to see. And it is this expansion that is the gift, is the reward for the work of doing the process. And it teaches you things that nothing else could teach you. It takes you to the shore where you always wanted to go, but with what you were working with, you never could have even selected the spot. So this is the spiritual dimension, if you will, or the next level of thinking, which is what I call it. It's part of what I call the evolutionary leap I think we're in. It's the next level of thinking that we're evolving from old-style thinking, which is very simplistic and literal and judgmental, to a consciousness beyond duality. It doesn't mean you don't observe what's not okay. It doesn't mean you disband judgment. You just don't become judgmental. Having judgment is a fluid, ongoing connection to life. Judgmental is a static, deadening, blaming, stuck place. In fact, I used to say it's getting stuck in what God used to be and not letting God be what it is now. And healing is always about going through the process. Going through the process of letting God be what it is now. And that takes humility, and that takes respect. That takes actually think it's a form of love. It's a trusting form of love. It's a trusting form of actually, truly loving God before it's jaded and jarred and characterized and legalized and ruleized and dogmatized. It's just there, and you see it in children. One of my favorite movies that shows this, and every time I get a little giggle in my heart every time I think of it, and it's a funny movie. It's called Galaxy Quest, and it was a spoof sort of on Star Trek, but it was more than that. It was about innocence, and the actors who played these aliens who think the Star Trek stories they've been seeing intercepting are historical documents. They come to be saved by the Star Trek cast, and it is their innocence, their hope, their sweetness, their trust that just makes my heart sing. And that's what we're missing. That's our great joy that we lose. And it's a very interesting thing. It's what heals us. It's what allows us not to get stuck in the grief. You know, humans are very interesting. We're the only creatures that really cry. And I remember thinking about that when I was quite young. And I always have had a mystical mind or a metaphorical mind. And I remember thinking, oh, we cry to wash our vision, to wash our eyes, to clear our vision, to release the pent-up hurt of something gone amiss, awry, off the mark, an evil, a not good thing, a violation from the Tao, the flow and the goodness of things. And to grieve, to cry, is to sort of expend the backup of energy. And the worst thing to do, which we all do sometimes, is to harden, because that seems like the brave front or the strong or the adult. And so often what we do is we harden our reactions so we're not ridiculed for being the sweet, innocent people that we truly are. And all of us when we're children are innocent, and all of us are ridiculed, and all of us are violated and taken advantage of, some much more than others, and some not so much more than others, but with a constitution that it's just devastating. So we're not to judge, we're just to heal. We're here to pay attention and have good judgment, but not be judgmental. Not try to dismiss certain categories of people because this is the root of racism of every sort, of ideological hatred, of religious dogma and hatred and war. It's all because it's an us and them. It's a short-sighted, pained, injured, unable to disengage from the injury place. And of course, that's what healing is. It's disengaging from the inner energy stuckness, the inner energy loop of injury, and to process it, to convert the energy from injury to insight. This is the payoff. This is what heals us. This is how you treat addiction. This is how you treat bad behavior. And it also requires, which is a kind of, I always would do this in a workshop visually, you know, you put your hands together and you let your fingers mesh like gears, you know, first one and then the other, then the other, then the other. So it's not one or the other, it's both all in small increments at the same time together. And the thing that is together is the trusting, the feeling, the discovery, the correction, and to see in other people that they're, when when they are cruel and violent and polarizing and reactionary and off in delusions of hatred and persecution of somebody because they are personifying, it's called projection, they're personifying the pain they feel inside that they don't want to process in themselves. It feels too humiliating, and that's the interesting thing. It is never, truly, never humiliating. It sometimes feels that way because, well, not sometimes, maybe always, that's the dragon at the door. I used to call it the dragon at the gates, the dragon at the door guarding your entrance into a deeper awareness. It's your child's defense against feeling that humiliation again, that ridicule. We hate to be ridiculed, and some people even more than others. It's like a stab wound to the heart. It's more than they can emotionally take. And when that happens to you as a child, you build often passive aggressive or aggressive defenses to or striving for power, so that you're not in that subservient position. That's why so many people who have huge amounts of power in the world are very dysfunctional, because they are driven by this injury, and that's why they don't usually, though there's always exceptions and there's always process going on, but usually they don't do a whole lot of real good for the world with all that power, because they still are coveting the endless, never satisfied, by the way, drive to be superior. That's another reason why humility is so powerful. Again, it doesn't mean you grovel. It doesn't mean it can't be fake, because if somebody hears me say you have to be humble, and then they go around, oh, you know, we've all seen that fake humility that people can have. It's very annoying, and it doesn't give them any freedom. It's just another way to get power. It's not over other people. It's not like I'm so humble. So, in amazing ways, you can be quite matter-of-fact in your innocence about something good about yourself, which may not sound humble. But humility isn't about that. It's not self-deprecating humor that we all like to see people who have a lot of power do, because it makes us feel less uncomfortable. It isn't about that. It's about genuinely being reflective and understanding the real meaning of modesty is not to harm or challenge other people. You know, whether it's sexual modesty so that you respect people's biological drives and you save the sexual hit for someone who you're interested in, not just so you can have power over people and get a claim. You know, this drive for fame is kind of mad. It kills the people who get the fame as well as the people who surrender to the obsession of seeking it, whether they get it or not. It's all out of insecurity, all out of immaturity, and it's out of a misplaced drive to be good, to be alive, to be connected, to be loved, to be loving. Those are all wonderful things and good, and we need to do things based on that real concern, not really about how do we look and how much money will I get. It's okay to get money. We live in a world that's exchange of energy that way. That's fine. Nothing wrong with having money. Not even anything wrong with having a great deal of money. There's only something wrong with thinking that makes you better, or when you don't use what you have to make life better. And so healing is energetic. It's very much about love. It's very much about self-correction and transforming from one level of consciousness and reality to the next. we are all opening. And people who have fame and have money are kind of placed there, I think, sometimes by God to, sometimes to go through their process in a public way, because when you are an archetype, that's what being famous is, you're an archetype for something, and you represent an image, an energetic structure or type, and it's for people to bounce off, to look at, the collective to look at. But when you claim your humanity and not just your fame or your archetypeness, when you move from that facade to the human, you bring many people along with you. Many people will get angry or disappointed to go, oh, they're not famous anymore. They're not who I thought they were, you know, because they're off seeking delusion. They're off seeking another drug to be deluded and distracted by. So you can't worry about that. You just have to keep thinking about what is wholesome, because that's how God washes you up on shore in the right place. That's how you get the real payoff from dis-ease, from the disharmony, from the injury. And sometimes some people will just be the archetypes of what doesn't work. So we can all see the rise and the fall. And the good thing, though, is to always pray and hope and send energy for the transformation from the fall into the enlightenment, into the awareness. And then you have people come back and apologize and explain what they did and why and where it came from as they discovered it. And what that does is open pathways, archetypal pathways for the collective. That's how we all grow. And it is different for different people. I'm not saying everybody has to do this or even should. I'm just saying it's part of the process. If you want it, you can do it. And if you don't want it, everybody's entitled to privacy. Everybody's really responsible for their own body, for their own growth, for their own healing, for their own transformation. Because the good news is, if you really do that, you will transform other people just by existing, even if you share nothing about your personal process. So I'm not making a should or ought on that at all. I'm just saying sometimes, as for instance in AA, when people talk about what they did and how it happened, they reaffirm the truth of it and the power of it, and they discover new things, and they help the others who were present reaffirm their own process, and that indeed this is a process, and oh look, I'm not alone, this happened. So I'm just trying to throw out all the parts to healing. And when it's like a physical disease, I started to say before, autoimmune diseases are and heart disease. I think it's heart disease is now past cancer, but I'm not sure. It keeps sort of moving back and forth. But heart disease, cancer is disowning your immune system and disowning parts of your body that then become susceptible either to the viruses or the mutation from the environment and chemicals and radiation and stuff that's around, or food you ingest that's toxic and stuff like that. Normally our bodies can handle quite a lot of stuff. We're quite amazing, and we can process a great deal. It reminds me, actually, as an example, I could tell you when I was in Kiev during Chernobyl, and I brought a group of 60 Americans and one Canadian, and we were on a peace group to the Soviet Union. And I believe it was when we landed, when we were in Helsinki, the Chernobyl exploded, and then we went directly to Kiev by train. We went to Kiev. I've gone so many times, I sometimes mix them up. But anyway, so we went to Kiev, and then we were there through Russian Easter, which is the holiest day of the year. The resurrection is more important than Christmas. It's the transformative passion. It's the passion of transformation from great suffering to great enlightenment. That's why Easter is so holy Russian Orthodox Church. In fact, just a little tiny aside, I was at one of the churches, and I was so touched with the candlelights and the people, the throngs of people, and the great love and spiritual feeling that you could feel in the church. And I don't feel that in a lot of Catholic churches anymore. It's gotten kind of cold and not quite as spiritual, I think, in many cases, at least where I've been. But so what happened was I was so touched. I actually started to cry. And this Russian woman, this old lady, came up to me and she said, "Don't cry, don't cry. He's risen. He is risen." And what the joy is that we transform and we take pain and injustice and suffering and we transform it. It is a metaphor. It is a parable. It is the holiest of gifts for the next level of transformation, that no matter how bad it was, you surrender to God, you forgive them for they know not what they do, and you become awake and different. And that's what that means. At least that's what I think it means in it. And I think it's what empowers people when they realize it. That I do know. But in any case, so we're there in Russia, and so we was in Ukraine, actually, and Kiev. And then Chernobyl went off, and we had people warn us and tell us. And later years, I came back, and I met with the mayor and the different people there, and they were telling me that they had a miracle fireman that, I don't know if any of you ever saw the Life magazine article on how people with radiation poisoning look, but basically their bodies liquefy and they die a horrible death because everything liquefies. And there was this one fireman who was pouring those chemicals right into the spewing, intense radiation pouring out of that radioactive tower that had collapsed, and he was still alive. And he said, "He is our miracle." Everyone else that had done that had died, most right away, some within months. But this was years later, and he was still alive, and nobody knew why. And I just love that, because there are ways. Sometimes it's a genetic boost, I grant you. We do come in with different DNA and different resources. And, you know, some have some resources that others don't. And those same that don't have resources, the others don't have. And sometimes they are mutually exclusive, that it's like you can't be tall and short at the same time sometimes. There's advantages to being tall and there's advantages to being short. And so, you know, it's just one of the ways it goes. So yes, there is a genetic difference. But there is also this capacity to heal by letting your body do it. And I remember being very struck, and this is another Life magazine picture in my mind from many, many years ago, where they were showing hypnosis, and they showed people who were touched with a hot iron, and they were hypnotized and told it was cool, and they didn't get a blister. And then they had people who were touched with a cool something, piece of metal, that was not hot, and they were told it was burning hot, and they were touched, and they got a burn blister. And I remember thinking, this is extremely significant. Why aren't people talking about this all the time everywhere? And when I went to Berkeley and I was studying psychology and conservation and so on, I remember wondering, too, then, why don't people study the placebo effect? This is the most significant thing, that this works. Why are we trying to design all these tests to eliminate the placebo effect? It's like we have this little linear-minded bias, and we're going to make everything fit in it, and don't count if it doesn't fit in it. Because placebo effect takes you outside of that linear box. It means something else is healing you. And it actually even seems to mean, because you think it, you're healing it. Uh-huh. And when you align with an image of holiness, of numinousness, of goodness, of freedom, of healthiness, when you allow that, perhaps as a symbol of spirit, maybe Jesus or Buddha or whoever resonates that image for you, the holiness, and you let it be in you and radiate from you, you become it. You align with it. It aligns with you, but mostly you are allowing yourself to align with it. It's already here. We just keep ourselves away from it by an immature mental style of thinking. So healing has so much to do with aligning with that. And as a healer, what I do is facilitate people experiencing that, because I feel it. I feel it so much. And when you feel it a great deal, especially when you have compassion for someone and you tune in and you can see the injuries, you begin to feel them, it's almost like you become a guide to walk through the injury. You know, I think of Yeda, I walk through the valley of shadow of death, hope, fear, no evil. Because you bring spirit along into the process. You facilitate it. And that's what healing is. Now, there's another ingredient to healing, which may be the same thing. Maybe it's just the Holy Spirit. I don't know. Shakti, you know, chi, whatever. But definitely, all my life, especially after I opened, I can radiate tremendous amounts of energy from my body. And when I'm talking, I try to put it into my voice so that people get a sense of feeling of it. But I can generate energy, and I can feel people get it, and they get it. They say, oh my God, what was that? How did you do that? And sometimes people get frightened, sometimes people bliss out. But basically, it's just whatever is part of that flow, that's part of what we call ESP, telepathy, connection, love, healing. They're all related. They're all part of an expanded kind of thinking that lets our intuitive mind, which is, I believe, our spiritual mind, the mind of genius, the mind of art, the mind of beauty, the mind of music and ideas that never were before. This is all part of the nature of healing. And every time we try to reduce it into a lot of ideological stuff and rules and rituals, not to say that rituals can't often inspire people to let go of the position they're in and shift to a newer position that's more open, and that's what they're used for, and that's when they're used for that, that's good. But I do believe that we're actually reaching beyond that, where we can just live in spirit, and we can live at the level of consciousness that allows us to automatically almost heal ourselves, heal our children, heal our mates, heal our friends, heal our leaders, heal our doctors, heal our police, heal our whole system of social organization, so that instead of being punitive and fearful and controlling and dominating and powerless feeling, it becomes connected and relaxed and open and trusting in the flow and in the process, and that you begin to realize that the person you have, the piece of the planet that you have the most control over, that you are most responsible for, is always yourself. It's always you. And the power to heal and self-correct yourself is the true nature of healing. Well, I want to thank you once again for being with me. Check out my website, download podcasts, send me your email address so we can let you know what we're doing. And remember, it is about love. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copywritten to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.